Hi, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday. It's the 15th of April. Oh, it's tax day. Joel, know it's tax day? It's tax day. Tax day. Everybody's excited. Tax day. Have three envelopes on the butcher block ready to go to the post office to be mailed.
I remember when we all in the media used to cover midnight on the 15th. We'd go over to the U.S. Post Office central, place in Colony and take pictures. TV would be there filming people coming in and getting their taxes in by midnight.
The line of cars.
Cars would be lined up.
The big bins of mail that they would bring it up to your car window and you'd shove it in there
right.
And you made the deadline.
You get postmarked by midnight, right?
By April 15th.
And then came the internet.
That's right. Screwed it all up. Well, good morning. Welcome to the program. We have a good one for you today. And I don't know. I think we do. It looked good on paper. I think we can probably actualize it, make it pretty good. And I hope you will be a part of it as well. That even makes it better. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Let me introduce our panel to you, and we will get started. Former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain is with us. Good morning, Michael. How are you?
I'm great. I'm happy to be here. It's a beautiful day out there. At least the first part of the day is supposed to be beautiful. Then I guess the wind and the rain come in. But,
yeah, but
we're used to that, aren't we?
But we're okay.
It's good right now.
It's good right now, and we'll take that. Also, I do want to welcome the former Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association. That's brand new. But longtime Daily Gazette editor, and you left the Gazette how many years ago?
Oh, 8 to 10 years ago.
Okay, been a while. And our two former editors here. So it's Judy Patrick. Good morning. Welcome. Very nice to have you here.
It is wonderful to be here. I'll tell you that as a sign of spring, I have my first case of poison ivy. You can get it from just the roots. As I know, I was in a bed I knew had poison ivy in it. I shouldn't have done it, and welcome spring.
What kind of gardening were you doing at this time?
I was turning my vegetable beds.
Oh.
And I had some poison ivy in there, I knew, and I said, I'm going to get those roots out of there. Had gloves on, but there's a spot in my wrist, on both wrists, that I have some poison ivy this morning. Welcome spring. I don't care. I'll take
it. Okay. It's your way. It's fine. Also, we welcome a newbie to our program. We're very happy to have him. I think everyone in this room knows Mark and his work for a long time, but he's new to our program, and we're excited about that. Former radio talk show host and TV news anchor, professional speaker, speaking coach, and member of the Albany County Legislature representing parts of Guilderland and Colony. Mark Grimm is here. Hello, Mark. How are you?
It's good to be with you all. It's very nice.
Very nice to have you here. Give us a sense. When did you first come to this market?
Well, I started as the voice of Siena basketball when I was at Siena.
Yeah.
My senior year.
Did you grow up here in
I grew up
area?
In Troy. And,
okay.
And then we moved out to Babcock Lake, which is out in the Rensselaer County. And the senior year of the Siena game, basketball games were not covered by any radio station. And that was the only time that ever happened. So I went to the dean and said, I know you have an advertising budget. What's better advertising than to do the games? I'll do the games and I won't charge anything. And I'll get a producer at WVCR, the college station. He said, fine, get me a budget and get back to me. I said, great. I left the room and I said, what's a budget? So I called the phone company and said, look, you just got to hook up the phone wire to this little board, and I would bring the board with me and find a jack and put it in, and then I would sometimes do the play-by-play right sitting in the stands. And when Siena was ahead by 20 points, that got a little hairy because the fans there weren't so happy about me broadcasting the game.
And then what TV stations were you on? You were on...
I was never in TV in Albany,
in this market,
which is strange.
Okay, yeah.
It just, I wanted to, but it never worked out. And then I got above Albany, frankly, with Denver and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I did have a radio show at WVCR, the Siena Alumni Connection, for 14 years.
There you go.
Where I was a volunteer.
Well, it's very nice to have you here this morning. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I appreciate you being here, and it's good to have you. I would just a quick little note, and I don't I realize that some people may be tuning in this morning to expect us to talk about the news of the White House asking Congress to claw back funding from NPR and PBS. Here's the thing. We don't know anything. We really don't know anything. And I think it will better serve us, all of us, especially here at the radio station, because I think there's a perception, and it's an accurate one, a perception that we would know something being a NPR station. But I think given the random nature of these executive orders and plans and things that are being written up, we just don't know how exactly it's going to impact us, when it's going to impact us, and what's going to impact. I am telling you, I promise, I make you this promise, when we know, that's all you're going to hear about for a really long time. So we're certainly not trying to hide anything. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out to us. We'd love to talk to you about it. It's just that we don't really know enough to talk about it other than what we've always known, which is that we were on the chopping block from the very beginning, and Republican administrations for the last five decades have been trying, 60s, right? Have been trying to eliminate money for public broadcasting. So this is the latest round. It seems like the most serious, and we'll see what happens. But as far as an in-depth conversation, I don't want to put our panelists on the hook on this. And so we'll just wait. We'll see what develops, and then we'll have a good conversation about it with people who know and have some numbers for us and can sort of make sense of what is coming out, the edict that is coming out from the White House. So don't worry. We'll talk about it. We want to talk about it. God knows we want to talk about it. I found out the big thing. I asked my main question, will my check clear this week? And they said yes. So that's good. All right, let's go with that. So let's start with other stories this morning, and we'll begin. And again, we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you. Harvard University, oh my goodness. So this is a really interesting story in which yesterday was playing out in real time. So the White House sends a letter to Harvard and says, if you don't do this, 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 and this, we're gonna freeze your money. And Harvard, unlike Columbia and other universities, said, no. And they wrote a letter, a two-page letter back, that said, we will not comply with this. Our job is for the students and for the history, to continue the history of this great university, and we will not be complying with the list of demands that you have set forth. So then, it didn't take long, federal officials said they would freeze $2.2 billion in multi-year grants to Harvard, along with a $60 million contract. Other universities have pushed back against the administration's interference in higher education, but Harvard's response, which called the Trump administration's demands illegal, marked a major shift in tone for the nation's most influential school, which has been criticized in recent weeks for capitulating to Trump administration pressure. A letter the Trump administration sent to Harvard on Friday demanded that the university reduce the power of students and faculty members over the university's affairs, report foreign students who commit conduct violations immediately to federal authorities, and bring in an outside party to ensure that each academic department is, quote, viewpoint diverse, among other steps. The administration did not define what it meant by viewpoint diversity, but it has generally referred to seeking a range of political views, including some conservative perspectives. No government, regardless of which party is in power, should dictate what private universities can teach, whom they can admit and hire, and which areas of study and inquiry they can pursue, said Alan Gerber, Harvard's president, in a statement to the university on Monday. All right. So this is a ongoing story, obviously, not just a Harvard story, but with other universities as well. Mike, what do you make of it?
Well, you know, no matter how big your endowment is, and Harvard's is huge by every measure, if you lose $60 million contracts and you lose $2.2 billion over a number of years, it is going to substantially alter what you're able to do as an academic institution, and it threatens that. Harvard contends that this is illegal. This action taken by the government is illegal. They don't have the right to exchange grant money and contracts for research, et cetera, to then demand, diversity among viewpoints on the faculty, whatever, to require the university to hand over information about students who are on student visas and all the other things that they're demanding, and including the elimination of any commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion. They want diversity of faculty members politically, but they don't want to allow diversity as a goal for the student body and the faculty at the at Harvard. And Harvard is calling them on this. Other universities have kind of knuckled down because they're so vulnerable to the federal money that pours in. And certainly, that's not small change. But I'd like to see what I don't quite understand which legal argument Harvard is going to use. They're being hailed by other universities. They're being hailed by faculty members across the board for standing up to the Trump administration here. And it's just another big fight that's going to take a long time to carry out. But at least they're taking a stand and demonstrating backbone, which I think is admirable. And, I mean, universities should be places of free thinking and free speech, and they should be academic sanctuaries where people don't have to worry about outside politics affecting what's going on. And you don't see the Trump administration going after Liberty University or some conservative college like that. So it definitely is not across the board. It is targeted at what are perceived as the elite universities like Harvard, Cornell, Columbia, et cetera, Penn, you name it. And they are doing this presumably to demonstrate that they have control over free speech and free thought.
Mark.
Yeah, I got a different view on that. I speak to a lot of young Republican clubs and schools over the years. And I had a great discussion one time with a bunch of young people, and they felt if they wrote an essay that was more liberal than conservative, they would get a better grade. I could think that in some cases that may be a reasonable conclusion, because universities are captives of a liberal ideology. There's no doubt about it. If you see any political poll, who they voted for, whether Republican or Democrat, it's like 85-15 or something like that. So if we want to have diversity, let's have it. But we don't have that on college campuses. And if you're getting federal money, listen, we couldn't run the Albany County without all the state money we get. But you know what? It all comes with strings. They said, you got to do this, you have to do that. So there's nothing inappropriate about having strings to the release of federal money. That happens all the time. The question is, what's fair and how do we get there?
And is what they're asking for fair, though?
Well, I think diversity is a good thing. But I don't think we have diversity of thought on many college campuses. And how do we change that?
Judy?
Chris Rufo is the conservative activist that has so lobbied for this for years. And he had a wonderful interview in the New York Times at Bastion of Liberal Thought, apparently, where he was very clear about what his goals are. And, you know, it's essentially to downsize our educational system. I think he wants colorblind admissions. He wants far less, far more conservative voices. And he makes arguments that are easily disputed. You know, if you want to talk about intellectual diversity and what the administration's view of intellectual diversity is, just look at the books they've culled from, you know, the libraries they do have control of. They will take out any book that talks about women's rights or the about slavery. I mean, they've been very clear about where they stand, and it's a focus on the white male culture. I mean, I went to college in the 1970s, and I can tell you, I was an English lit major, and I was a women's studies minor. And I always wondered, why are we all in women's literature or in English literature? Why are we just studying what men have written about men's lives? And if I hadn't had the women's studies courses, I would not have known that women had some issues back in history, that women could write, that people of color could write, that for God's sake, wonderful novels were written by people from other parts of the world. Our institutions of learning for so many years were just institutions of white male privilege. And thank God someone has stepped in. I've been thinking the last few days of what's going to happen to us if we continue down this course. Are we going to get rid of the, you know, smoking is dangerous signs at the, you know, at your local convenience store? How far back are we going to go? We had made so much progress in terms of enlightening people about the fact that racism is wrong, that sexism is wrong, and now we're just going backwards.
We'll pause there and we'll continue the conversation when we come back. We welcome your thoughts on this issue. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we'll get to your letters. Just asking that they be short and to the point so we can get to as many as possible. We will continue after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, talking about Harvard University. And they're standing up to the Trump administration and this over money. And now at this point, with Harvard saying that they are not going to comply, that $2.2 billion will go away, according to the administration. I just wanted to read a couple of lines from a columnist from the Boston Globe, Shirley Ling, who wrote about the title of this commentary is, "Did Harvard Just Grow the Backbone We've Been Waiting For?" That collective sigh of relief you heard around Greater Boston on Monday afternoon, that was all of us exhaling after Harvard finally did the right thing, refusing to comply with demands of the Trump administration that would have threatened the academic freedom of universities everywhere. In other words, Harvard grew a backbone, and not a moment too soon. The university will not surrender to independence or relinquish its constitutional rights, according to the president. Alan Garber, writing in a message to the campus, "No government, regardless of which party is in power, should dictate what private universities can teach, whom they can admit and hire, and which areas of study and inquiry they can pursue. Take that, President Trump." But Garber didn't stop there in his nearly 800-word note of defiance, aptly titled "The Promise of American Higher Education." It was a level of fire that I didn't expect from the medical doctor turned college administrator who took the reins just over a year ago after the resignation of Claudine Gay. What I am interested in from after reading that and to talking to our panelists is, so what does Harvard have that the others didn't, in the sense of being able to, quote unquote, have that backbone?
Hey, they saw what happened to Columbia. Columbia conceded, and it didn't make things better for Columbia, I think. And it also had Princeton, the Princeton president had come out a week or so ago with a statement. They had not been attacked yet with the promise of loss of funding. And the Princeton president said they were not going to back down. They were going to stick to it, too. So even though they hadn't directly been threatened, I think there is a movement growing. There's also some lawsuits the university presidents have gotten together to file to challenge this. The question is, what's everybody else going to do at this point? Are they going to cut the legs out from under Harvard and let them go alone? Are they going to, you know, stand up, pony up, and get the same backbone?
I realize that all
situations are different, but wouldn't it make more sense if there was some uniformity and some united front amongst the universities?
According to the Princeton president, there is a weekly meeting of a lot of university presidents where they are talking about just this issue.
Be on that call.
Yeah, but it's. I think it could possibly be a Pyrrhic victory if they're able to stop or at least get a court to say that these contracts must be honored, that we're approved already for these universities. But it'll definitely result in slowing down of future contracts and change the dynamic that by which they're funded by the federal government. Even if they win some court cases, it just seems like it's mutual destruction. You know, it's a lot like a trade war where both sides lose and everybody else loses. It's basically a disagreement between the administration in the White House and how universities are run, and trying to impose their ideology and perspective on these campuses, which have been, places where liberal thought has absolutely dominated for decades.
So in this particular opinion piece that was published by the Boston Globe, however, not alone, many, many people are saying the same thing about Columbia, that they, quote, caved. Do you see them as caving?
Well, they're trying to stand up for what they believe in. But I think when you ask for federal money, then you're not as independent as you say you are. And because all government money, the people that are giving the money have an idea of how that should be spent. Now, I don't think the government should be running universities, but it seems to me that the universities should be more accepting of the idea that there should be more conservative ideology to join liberal ideology on campuses. That's only fair.
But I wonder, does it impact the... It would make more sense to me, and I haven't read enough on this to see an actual example of how there has been, of what the administration is alleging has had a direct impact on the programs that they're pulling the funding from.
I see what you mean. It's, in other words, they disagree with Harvard's inclusion program that lets the faculty have a strong say in,
right,
in the way the university operates and the students the same, and they might disagree with a particular institute or program they have on Middle East studies and the way that it's staffed and some of the faculty members and things that the faculty members have said. So they're going to cut funding that might be research on how to deal with Parkinson's disease, or might have some technological advantage on microchips. It's like punitive. We're going to hurt you there because we don't like what you're doing here.
And as far as in a recent paper that I read from from Johns Hopkins, Parkinson's disease does not have a political affiliation.
Right, exactly, and that's a really good point. but it could end up, if Johns Hopkins doesn't comply to whatever mandates the feds put on Johns Hopkins University, it could end up infringing on their ability to do the very amazing research that they're doing. You know, I mean, it's like. It is so destructive. It's destructive every step of the way. Universities have been able to have, you know, flurries of discussions and studies that focus on different ideologies while still doing incredible things that benefit all of society. And this is breaking that arrangement.
One of the things that I thought was interesting in the letter that was sent back to the administration from Harvard and their attorneys in this case was that you initially told us that we did this, 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 and this wrong when it came to anti-Semitism on campus. We changed this, 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 and this, and hopefully to make that situation better. In other words, so now you're moving the goalpost. And you asked us to change these things. We changed these things. We're going to let them play out, see if they actually improve the situation as you see it, and hopefully the way we want it to make it fairer. But then this obviously takes it a step further.
And there's a real danger for us of a brain drain. If you're a young research scientist and you're trying to decide where you want to do your research for the next 10, 15, 20 years, are you going to stay in the United States where we have such political uncertainty about what will happen to your funding, or do you go elsewhere? Do you go to Australia? Do you go to Great Britain? Do you go to Germany? I mean, and one of the most wonderful things that has been the influx of immigrants into our country who have come to our shores and done and gotten educations and have brought us wonderful innovations in all sorts of fields. So I worry about that as anyone who knows, you know, we have been so focused on STEM. Remember, you know, we wanted all our young people to get into, you know, science. And now we're pulling the rug out from under them.
I'm teaching over at Bennington College. And you talk about the brain drain. But these kids are great. I mean, they're so smart. They're so engaged. They're interested in the world. But to the point of, we have so many international students. And not only are those international students important for us and for the university, but also for the other students who are there to realize these other perspectives. And those perspectives that are brought up within the course and within the campus, I find just to be extraordinary, that unfortunately wouldn't be there if they weren't there.
You know, we talk about why diversity, equity and inclusion is important. I know that those are bad words, but I mean, from my career, looking
quote
back,
unquote,
quote unquote.
Yeah,
I mean, God help me if I use that term.
It used to be, you know, that horrible word diversity.
But you know, having people who come from different circumstances, people who grew up in different places, in your orbit, helps you think better. I mean, we had I was in a white male newsroom for a long time, and it wasn't until we had people of color come into the newsroom where we started to realize that we weren't covering things as well as we could have, and that they offered us a perspective that we just couldn't have, and it was a good thing to have.
Without putting you on the spot, did they feel that way? Do you think they felt that way when they had a woman editor?
Yes, indeed they did.
Yeah. Mary writes to us and says, why do colleges need to be fair or equal? When looking for colleges, my daughters looked for colleges that fit with their ideology. One was liberal, one was conservative. They took on issues that suited these beliefs while in college and beyond. They were both private schools, and as a family of different views, never felt anything was unfair or not equal. Whether a university is liberal or conservative shouldn't be a test of quote-unquote loyalty and whether or not they get federal grants. That from Mary. Then we go to this note from Jocelyn, who says, accusing colleges and universities of having a liberal ideology of not having diversity doesn't make sense to me. Isn't a liberal ideology diverse by its very nature? Isn't liberalism diverse? More diverse, perhaps, than conservatism. Then we go to Ray. Please discuss the crucial role of academic freedom in sustaining an excellent academic education. Mark, I'll throw that one to you.
Yeah, I think, how can you be for diversity when there's one language? It's not when there's one predominant way of thinking. That's not diversity. So, in fact, Tim Russell wrote a book about this, and he said, yeah, we've been really good at promoting racial diversity in our newsrooms, but how well have we done with political ideology? What I want is a place where all these ideologies are exercised, and we don't have that today.
The crucial role of academic freedom in sustaining an excellent academic education. Academic freedom obviously is something that we talk about a lot, Mike. How do we ensure that there is such a thing?
I think it's making a commitment to it. It's to be open-minded to it. You know, when there's when you have a conservative college and a liberal professor comes along, it can be very rough going for them. And the the university or the college needs to make a commitment that they're going to protect that faculty member, and vice versa. If there's a, you know, in the same situation, a liberal campus, and they have their conservative professor whose opinions and points of view are different than the rest of the faculty, they need to make a commitment to make that a safe haven for that professor to teach and for students to engage in that. And, you know, you get these groups on campus, you know, maybe it's a liberal campus, but they have Harvard students for, Bush or something like that. You know, I mean, they exist, you know, and they need to coexist and be and protect that right for people to have that. I mean, academic freedom is a commitment that the universities have to make. And the fact that more, you know, it seems that to some of these Ivy League schools, more liberals flock there. It's because they find it a place where they can express themselves and do very well, you know.
Many liberal institutions have produced very conservative politicians.
Yes. I mean, that should be pointed out.
Interesting as well, yes.
Bob, can I just ask you this? On some campuses, they're chanting "The River to the Sea." Is that free? Is that free speech when Jewish kids are walking by and they're afraid to go to class? Is that acceptable free speech?
Acceptable speech. It's offensive speech, and it should be called out and not tolerated.
But is it free speech? I mean, the issue of free speech is an interesting one. It becomes a problem when it incites violence, when it's dangerous. I mean, free speech is a really hard concept for a lot of Americans to grasp. Hateful speech often is free speech. It's a matter of the situation where it is, and it's a matter of the intent of what whoever is saying it. So
there is intimidation on campuses, and Jewish students have talked about it, and there needs to be some repercussions for that.
Oh, I think there have been, and I think that university, in this case of Harvard, they took steps that addressed. In, you know, what they believe addressed the problem that did develop when Jewish students were made to feel unsafe by just what you described, Mark. You know, people embracing chanting that is a deep threat that threatens the existence of Israel. I think that Harvard took steps. Other universities have taken steps. Were they immediate? Did they do it right away? What, has it been effective? I think that's an ongoing debate. And I don't think it was immediate, and I think there was acknowledgement that they needed to do more right by the universities. And, you know, the Columbia situation is a good example. But the, colleges are imperfect. They evolve just like everything else in society. And you just can't take a single incident and use it to, you know, dramatically change or try to dramatically change overnight the way that our university system, which has served us pretty darn well, despite its many, many flaws, has existed for a long time. Evolution needs to happen.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have more letters, and we'll get to those before the top of the hour. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion talking about Harvard University this morning and what is transpired, where the administration wrote them and said, if you do not do this, 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 and this, we will remove $2 billion from your budget plus. And then Harvard said, well, go at it, because we're not going to change our structure. And so now we're talking about this on the program this morning. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Deborah writes, why does the safety of Jewish students exceed the safety of black people, against whom hate speech has been systematically targeted and yet is completely protected? Then Janice, what exactly is the current conservative ideology? It seems as if the predominant conservative point of view embraced by this administration consists primarily of conspiracy theory and echoes of white replacement and misogyny. That from Janet.
Then we go to Sandra. Is this Sandra? Yes. It's just so typical of this administration that they use the tagline of education should be up to the states while exercising more control of education content from the department than any other administration ever. That from Susan.
You know, one of the things I learned about in my, it was a long time ago, was that the conservative approach to government was small government, was reduced reduced spending, was by and large the underlying philosophy of conservatism. And I learned that when I was in college. And is that wrong? I mean, it seemed, and as I followed local government, I you see it less in local government, conservative, liberal leanings on such. But
I don't know about that.
Being an Albany County legislator, do you agree with that?
Ideology. But that's what my general approach to, you know, what I think of as conservatism. Over the years, however, you've gotten social issues involved in the conservative approach to what they think is appropriate for government. And so that's changed since the 70s when I was in school.
Yeah, I would say one example is abortion. I think the Republicans are getting killed on that issue because I believe in individual liberty over the heavy hand of government, and I think that's really what I would underscore as Republican philosophy. But when a woman is faced with the most difficult decision of her life, you really can't have the government making that decision. That should be the woman to make that decision. That, to me, is conservative philosophy, that we have to constantly fight the heavy hand of government on behalf of individual liberty, because it's threatened everywhere around the world. And when people are in power, they tend to want more power, and that's been true of all the parties. So that's why the philosophy that you outlined is important to defend all the time. And we have these checks and balances because we don't want any single House or Senate or presidency or Supreme Court to have the ultimate say. And that's where a lot of this stuff is going to be battled in the courts. And I do think they're overdoing it. Almost everything, every position that Trump takes now is being challenged in court. And everyone has a right to exercise their rights to appeal. But the reality is, the amount of cases is far surpasses what we've ever seen before.
We go to John, who says, "I thought conservatism meant limited government. Dictating what can be taught at universities is not limited government." And then we receive this from Bob. "Why do the most wealthy universities need government money? Maybe these grants could be used for less wealthy universities. Maybe it's time these Ivy League schools started to use some of their endowment money to support those schools."
Yeah, you know, he brings up a good point. Most people don't go to Harvard, Yale, and Columbia, or Princeton, and Penn, and Cornell. Most people go to other colleges, and a lot of people don't go to college. And I think there's a lot of resentment that people have for people who have these opportunities to go to these schools and other major schools. And there is this, sense of let's take them down, let's knock them down a notch. They don't need to, but they have been very successful with a lot of flaws. Don't get me wrong; they've been very successful, and they've turned out presidents, they've turned out corporate leaders, they've turned out technology and discoveries in science and medicine that have benefited all of us. And to just unilaterally break that up and say you're going to send the money to this college or that college to support that doesn't really continue what has been a very successful system that our country has become strong on.
Correct. I agree. Although there are partnerships that are done then with, under the auspices of say, a Harvard, with other universities where there are partnerships, and those should honored as well.
I'm not disagreeing with that. It needs to be collaborative, and Harvard is a good example. I can't believe I'm defending Harvard, you know, but Harvard is a good example of the fact that you get into Harvard.
Fran and Terry asked you to do a favor,
right? But Harvard is a good example of a school you get into, and if you can't afford to be there, you'll still go there. You know what I mean? And that's what endowments are meant for. And it has allowed a lot of people to go there who are not from the wealthy class. Ted Cruz, for example.
One more letter before we go to a break. Laura, who writes, panel, it is true that all viewpoints need to be presented at colleges and universities. Which of these colleges did the Supreme Court, the president, vice president, and many congresspeople graduate from? They were able to keep their viewpoints. When you have a leader of the country who surrounds themselves with people who only will reinforce their ideology, there is an example of no diversity. So their calling for diversity is an oxymoron. All right. We'll stop there for the moment. We'll come back. We'll work on new topics as we continue. First, we're going to take a break, and then news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. I just looked up and Ray had us in a smoking lounge in the 70s
jazz
here.
Music. Yes.
Yeah,
that's, that's radio for you, right?
Yeah, that's yeah. Very good.
Old time radio.
Okay, so moving on, we welcome you. Welcome back to the program. Just real quick, remind you who is with us. Former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain, former Vice President for Editorial Development of the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, and former radio talk show host and TV news anchor, professional speaker and speaking coach, and member of the Albany County Legislature, Mark Grimm, is with us. And we thank you all for being here. The Salvadoran president said Monday that he does not plan to return a Maryland man whom the Trump administration mistakenly deported to his country as the U.S. judicial system barrels toward a potential constitutional crisis over the standoff. How can I return him to the United States, said President Bukele in an Oval Office meeting with President Donald Trump, responding to a reporter's question. I smuggle him into the United States? Of course I'm not going to do it. The question is preposterous. How can I smuggle a terrorist into the United States? Kilmar Abrego Garcia, a Salvadoran immigrant who is married to a U.S. citizen who was deported last month to El Salvador's brutal mega prison. His case has become a focal point of the Trump administration's attempt to deport more than 1 million immigrants from the United States, and the court battles over the legality of that campaign. The Supreme Court on Thursday backed a lower court ruling that requires the White House to facilitate the releases of Abrego Garcia. But the justices stopped short of saying a lower court judge could order the administration to actually guarantee his return. Trump officials suggested Monday that the administration was not bound to follow court orders to return Abrego Garcia from El Salvador. No court in the United States has right to conduct the foreign policy of the United States, said Secretary of State Marco Rubio and during the Oval Office meeting. But the administration in court proceedings also has conceded that Abrego Garcia's removal was the result of a, quote, administrative error. Judy.
Oh, I so try to keep an open mind about this, but that press conference or that Oval Office session yesterday was one of the most shameful things that has ever happened in American history, I think, because we have our president standing next to a dictator from Latin America talking about whispering to him that he's going to have to build five more prisons because he's going to on the table, seriously on the table now, is deporting American citizens there. I mean, due process is a fundamental right in our country, and it applies not just to our citizens but to other people as well. You saw people, toadies around him, you know, just assenting. I worry that this is what's going to happen with Supreme Court decisions. They're just going to interpret them to say whatever they want them to say. You know, a word, this, it's a Lewis Carroll thing, you know, a word means what I mean, what I want it to mean, nothing more, nothing less. And to have Stephen Miller just totally
Gaslighting.
Gaslighting, yeah. And then an aside, not the most important issue, but the treatment of the press yesterday was just horrendous. I mean, Caitlin Collins is trying to ask legitimate questions right. that should have been asked, and he just, the president, President Trump, bullies her mercilessly.
Why didn't you ask why I'm keeping this country safer? Why aren't you asking? And then he went to
and I know
a
that's not
friendly
the,
face.
Yeah, I know that's not the most important issue, but what it does is continue to demonize the press, which undercuts Americans' trust in the press, which undercuts America's ability to know what the truth is.
As a separate issue, I do want to get into one of the big parts of that, of course, was the Associated Press.
And we'll, not covering
we'll,
that.
We'll get into that separately in just a moment. Also, you would think, and I don't know, maybe this is asking too much, but you would think that when you say, how could I let a terrorist, you would think the responsible thing regardless would be, well, not a terrorist, or even accused, but that's not even the case.
No.
So I don't know the lack of correction and I said this yesterday, I'll say it again today. It's harder and harder to believe that this was a quote unquote administrative error when they're working so hard to make sure that this person is not returned.
Well, I think it may well have been an administrative error because the Solicitor General of the United States said that in a court, and they claimed that that it was just an error that sent Mr. Abrego Garcia to El Salvador and into this awful, god-awful prison down there. President Bukele of El Salvador sat next to the president and said that he cannot return Garcia. I cannot just smuggle him here. All he needs to do is let him out of the prison, and Garcia can take a commercial airline back to the United States where he can have his due process, which he already had in 2019 before an immigration court, and they elevated his level of asylum that they granted him. So he shouldn't have any problem staying here, especially since the government has acknowledged it was an error in the first place that put him on that plane to El Salvador. And the notion that Trump and his Stephen Miller and everybody makes that we cannot compel a foreign country to do this. He's sitting next to the guy. We're bankrolling this country and its prison system, talking, as Judy pointed out, about expanding it and putting more down there, more prisoners down there, even possibly U.S. citizens. I mean, it's just preposterous that the president of the United States cannot say, we would like you to let that guy out so he can come back here and we can correct that error. Instead, they're gaslighting. They're saying now the guy is a terrorist and the president has a right to keep him out, even though there is no evidence to support that whatsoever. And that already was dealt with in the court with the district court who ordered the government to get him back. So, I mean, it's just preposterous. And Caitlin Collins, I mean, you got to respect a good reporter who pushes to ask the right questions while others are yelling things about, tell us about your health, oh, tell us how great your golf game is, and all these obsequious things that are coming from the band of quote-unquote reporters that the White House press corps is now filled with thanks to the changes in policies while the Associated Press sits outside. But enough said.
Mark?
Yeah, I just think, first of all, non-citizens don't have the same rights as citizens. They just don't. That's
But the courts have said, Mark, pardon me, that they are entitled to due process. This man had none.
But that's not the same thing, Mike. There's a difference between the rights afforded citizens versus the rights of non-citizens. Okay, let's be clear about that.
But due process is their entitlement.
Okay, yeah, okay.
And they do have the right to free speech.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Okay.
We're overlooking the problem that Trump has fixed, first of all, is the open border. Biden had an open border, millions and millions of people. We're going to be feeling the ramifications of that for decades. And in 2 months' time, he didn't need bipartisan legislation. He through an executive action, they reduced the crossings of the border by 95% is the last one that I saw. So let's acknowledge this pretty remarkable success. Everyone was one of the two issues in the campaign really were inflation and then the border. And this has been very successful. Now, if this man is there for no good reason, they should give him back.
For no good reason, they should give him back?
Yeah, they should bring him back. Yeah,
You agree.
Yeah. But I think the broader issue is immigration. People were clamoring to get the border problem fixed, and Trump fixed it. Because people know now there's less likelihood of success if you're just going to come across and storm the border. And all the problems that comes with it, the fentanyl, the human trafficking, all of these things are terrible. And this overall was an attempt to do something about it. This is a distraction, I think, really, from the overall picture. And if he is entitled to come back, he should. And I don't think I think if he called the El Salvador guy, he would say, you know, okay, send him over.
Yeah, but, you know, there's, I think, documented maybe 17 or 18 out of the more than 200 people that went down there, 17 or 18 of them actually were involved in gang activities and convicted of crimes back in their home country, mostly Venezuela. And the others, it's just like tattoos they wore, clothes they wore, the age. And you got to remember, what Bukele, the president in El Salvador, and we call him a president, but he's more like a dictator. What he's done in El Salvador is he's taken, thousands and thousands of kids, teenagers and young men off the street with no due process and thrown them into the prison. And this is something that we're trying to mirror now. We're taking away due process and just rounding up people, throwing them on a plane and sending them off, paying another country to put them into a hellhole prison. And it is a hellhole. They have no rights there. They don't have access to attorneys. They don't have access to the Red Cross. There is no due process involved, and they're pretty much gone and forgotten. And that is not the United States of America. I don't care what you say.
Well, I think the United States of America is having a secure border. It's one of the most important things the country can do for us. And our border is much more secure now than it was 6 months ago. And that's not disputable.
You know, NBC has a report today that ICE doesn't release a lot of information, but apparently in March, ICE deported fewer people than in March than the Biden administration did a year ago.
Fewer people are coming.
Yeah. Well, do I think the a strong border was the most important or the most serious problem facing our country? No.
Well, the polls are pretty clear.
The perception is
there,
that.
It was a perception
inflation
in
the border.
By the right-wing media. Yeah. So.
Well, no, it's the people. They voted. The two principal issues in the voters' minds were inflation and the border.
And I think this particular case about the man wrongly sent to the El Salvador prison is undermining the president's support the president has for the immigration. You can see it eroding in the polls. He needs to admit they were wrong. Although Stephen Miller yesterday was saying, no, the Solicitor General who made that admission in court, who said that it was an administrative error, we put him on administrative leave, he was wrong. I mean, Miller's trying to claw that one back. And I can see that being the approach the administration is going to take, rather than just bring this guy back.
Well, I agree. It's taking up a lot of oxygen
But I think it's symbolic. It's not the only one. I mean, they're taking people from college campuses. They're banning faculty members at college campuses who are not U.S. citizens because they might sign an opinion piece. That's what happened to the professor at Tufts University. She signed an opinion piece that criticized Israel, and that's all she had to do. It's like gone. These people are being, they're basically being rendered elsewhere when they break the rules. And the rule is that you can't have free speech.
I think we're missing, and I mean we're having a good conversation here, but to me the thing that I just curled my toes, not that they aren't already, but that's really none of your business, is that there was this idea of Trump saying that he's all for jailing American citizens in El Salvador's mega prisons and saying that homegrowns are next.
Yeah, he said that many times. It's not the first time he said it. And there's talk about
telling this guy, get ready, build more prisons. We'll fill them up.
Yeah. I mean, that's a frightful
those are American citizens you're talking about.
Yeah, he's talking about...
They have all the constitutional rights that are right.
Well, they may, but once they're whisked away in the middle of the night and we don't know where they went, and then they go to El Salvador, we'll throw our hands up saying, we can't do anything.
And then we say we have no authority.
No authority
to do it.
It could happen to anyone.
They're also talking about making sections of El Salvador part of under U.S. control so we can build prisons there and offshore our prisoners. You know, I mean, this is scary, scary stuff. This is stuff that sounds more draconian than people could have possibly imagined. And as much as, you know, the border issue certainly was terrifying to people in the middle of the country who had no geographic connection to the border were terrified that people were going to come into their homes and rape them. That was because of the completely extreme misinformation that was being put out by the administration. The reality was much different than that.
Well, I can tell you the reality right in our area. They kicked American citizens out of a motel that's less than a mile from my home. Mm-hmm. And they said, get out. You got 2 hours to get out. And they filled it up with illegal immigrants. And the reason the hotel did it is that it was a payday for them. They wound up, they were out of code.
That was New York City. That was New York City and the hotel owner that did that. That wasn't the federal government.
But that's one of the problems.
I know. The perception is we've been kicked out of our hotel, therefore we got to kick these people out of the country. And
no, it just wasn't fair to American citizens who had two-hour notice to get out.
I completely agree. It was unfair, but it was.
But it was brought on by the just rushed the border for 4 years, and we've really. Let's concede that we've made progress
poor
in that
policy.
Area.
Can we concede
that we made progress in that area? That we have 95% fewer people crossing the border now.
Let's go to just a couple more letters, and then we'll move on. Seeking asylum is not illegal. Trump has not fixed the immigration issue. He has simply ended the legal process of applying for asylum. That from Madeline.
And this is an issue Congress really needs to address, but they're not brave enough to do it. So.
Stephen writes, actually it's Patricia, who says, please speak about what is up with Stephen Miller and his role. Thank you.
Way too much power. He is. I thought that in the first Trump administration, his far right ideology was controlled a little bit by the normal people in the Trump's administration. But this time, he's got the he's a scary dude. I listening to him talk. He is strident. He is scarier to me than the president. And the president of the United States should not be scary to me.
And you know the other thing, too, is that it's just remarkable of given how many people have gone through the administration, as with all administrations, not just Trump's administration, but he's the one guy that was there from the beginning.
Yeah, you got to give him credit for that.
From the beginning. Let's go to David. The main reason they will not return Kilmar Garcia back to the United States is that Trump will never admit to making a mistake, and that is just period.
Where do you think this is going to go? I mean, the Supreme Court has left one little thing open in saying that the judge has to be careful, the district court judge has to be careful in that they, a judge at that level can't compel the government to negotiate with another country. But it doesn't remove the ability of us just to ask for that guy back. Will it go to Congress? Congress is doing nothing. They're just sitting back on their hands.
And what are the Democrats doing, really? I mean, I hear some little peeps once in a while, but not
The senator, the U.S. senator, the Democrat from Maryland, is going to El Salvador in an effort to try to speak to President Bukele because he was denied the opportunity to speak to him while he was here in the U.S. yesterday. I think people have to stand up and start taking action. And
this arrangement is a one-year arrangement, the $6 million for 1 year. Because I was curious about whether or not these people are going to be in this prison for the rest of their lives. Was this a life sentence that they got? So it's only a year. So what happens after the first year is my question. And, you know, there's also the idea that at one point I would think lawyers for this man would file a civil lawsuit. I mean, he's been wrongly detained. Who do you sue, though?
ICE. was their error.
Let's go to another topic, if we can. We'll start with... Yes, we have time. Let's go to another topic on the docket this morning. And I would like to get to the story about the Associated Press and talk a little bit about this issue. Have three journalists in the room here, so let's tackle this one. Whatever we don't get to, we'll do on the other side of the break. Last week, a federal judge in D.C. ordered the White House to stop preventing Associated Press journalists from attending presidential events because the news organization's decision to continue using the name Gulf of Mexico. This is for the AP style guide. It was their recommendation and what they put in the guide as a result. Judge Trevor McFadden decided to lift the ban, which had been in effect since February 11th, while the AP's lawsuit against the White House plays out, arguing in a scathing ruling that blocking the news organization's journalists over a style book decision violated their constitutional rights. He stayed his own ruling for 5 days to allow an appeal, meaning it expired Sunday, but on Monday, it was as if nothing had changed. The AP was not included in the limited pool of journalists covering the president, as it had been before the ban. And when AP journalists attempted to cover Trump's Oval Office meeting with the president of El Salvador, they were rebuffed. Our journalists were blocked from the Oval Office today, AP spokesperson Warren Easton said. We expect the White House to restore AP's participation in the pool as of today, as provided in the injunction order. While AP photographers were permitted to cover a 3 p.m. presidential event with the Ohio State University football team on the South Lawn, they didn't want the missing of the dropping of the trophy. McFadden issued the injunction on April 8th, arguing that the White House had improperly discriminated against the AP and had caused significant concrete harms. Judy.
Well, I think this was expected, although I'm still disappointed. And the Associated Press is a legacy news organization in which hundreds of local media outlets rely on for their news out of Washington. This is really important. Not being in the room, as their photographer testified during a hearing on this a couple of weeks ago, it dramatically affects their ability to produce timely, accurate, compelling news for their members. And they're a cooperative. It's a member. It's not a company. It's not a for-profit company. So the idea of, well, we're going to appeal this and we're going to keep you out while we appeal this, this is time is money. You cannot wait. Time is news, I guess, is my approach. This is just the continued assault on the press. You can't. The reason the judge ruled in the AP's favor was the fact that the Trump administration did this just out of spite. Essentially, they didn't like the fact that they used words that the Trump administration did not want them to use. AP had a very solid reason for continuing to use the Gulf of Mexico. They serve people around the world, and the whole rest of the world did not change the name of this body of water. So it's perfectly reasonable what they did. They're standing up, just like the assault on Caitlin Collins, just like on the threat of suing 60 Minutes every time they write a negative story, just as the threat to sue ABC. I mean, the assaults continue, and news organizations continue to cave. God bless AP for sticking up for their rights.
Mike Spain.
Yeah, it is important to remember that this is not about any flaws in the AP's coverage. It's about, just as you said, Judy, it's revenge. It's the they're angry that they didn't change their style to call the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America, as Trump edicted on his first day back in office. And the courts have pretty much backed it up, but now they're appealing. It'll end up probably in the Supreme Court. It's just part of a Stephen Miller orchestrated campaign against the establishment news media. that has covered the White House and has had adversarial relationships with every president in my lifetime, going back to, you know, when Nixon was in office, when I was in college, you know, there were hostilities between Nixon and CBS and the New York Times and the Washington Post, but they continued to cover it. And there's, you know.
Got to take a quick break.
Yeah,
and we'll be right back.
Yeah.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We are talking about AP, the Associated Press, being kept out of White House press conferences and press events that cover the White House. This is after a federal judge ordered the White House to stop preventing the AP journalists from attending presidential events because of the news organization's decision to continue using the name Gulf of Mexico. Mark.
Well, as a reporter, I was often the guy in the room who was asking the hardest questions. And I don't think the people behind the podium appreciated it sometimes. But that's what the press's job is, asked tough questions. And the AP is a unique situation. They're not a single network or something like that. They have hundreds of outlets, and they all have different ideologies. So, yeah, the AP should be in the room. I do think we should, with social media now, we should think a little differently about mainstream media and say, let's allow some of these other voices in the room. And, you know, there's just so many seats to go. So, I'm okay with a rotation basis or something like that. But you just can't say the AP can't come to your press conference.
Yeah, there was this, you know, there's been some criticism of the White House press corps for not doing something more to support the AP's quest to still be in the room. You know, should they have boycott events? If they do that, then what you are going to be left with are people like from Lindell TV,
right? The
My Pillow TV station. So, you know, if the White House press corps had boycotted yesterday's event in protest, then you wouldn't have heard those Caitlin Collins questions about what was happening in El Salvador.
Yeah, it's not the time to boycott. It's the time to continue to aggressively cover and tell whatever is going on.
I know.
Yeah,
I think,
but a boycott, now you're getting involved in the political politics of it. We're supposed to be neutral, you know, journalists. So I don't think you can boycott and become part of the story. But you can advocate that everybody be treated fairly in the newsroom, and you can ask any questions you want.
Right. I think it's to the upper level, the upper management, or the people that run those companies to reach out to the White House and say, this is not acceptable, and not so much for the reporters. I think at one point they were just wearing little stickers that saying they support the AP. And I don't think that was quite enough. But they've got to recognize what's happening. And everyone in this room will admit that a press conference typically isn't the best way to get news anyway. I mean, usually you have to work sources. People are telling you stuff off the record. Those are when you get the real news. I mean, sure, the performance of an Oval Office press conference is interesting, and it makes one day news. But to really get solid investigative news, you've got to spend your time more wisely in the halls of these offices, although we've been, as an industry, banned from a lot of these buildings.
You know, it reminds me of you know the either the jokes or the TV programs or the movies where you have the jail cell, and the one person says, you know, what are you in for? And, oh, I'm in for murder. What are you in for? I'm in for armed robbery. You know, what are you in for? You know, jaywalking. What are you in for? I called it the Gulf of Mexico. It just, the whole thing seems very silly and petty.
Well, I mean, it was regarded as, I mean, there was a, you know, Judy described the reasons AP used well, but it was regarded by the administration as a defiance, an act of defiance. You want to call it that? We're not going to call it that. And that's not really what it was, but I think it was regarded as that and portrayed as that by the Trump White House, you know, and by the press secretary, et cetera, that they don't have a place there because they're being defiant. It's a bad time for the news media because The trust in the news media gets diminished every time there's one of these attacks. And if the news media should it not be aggressive? Of course it should be aggressive. Should it not ask the hard questions? Of course it should. And in a lot of ways, the fact that often politicians on both sides of the aisle don't like a certain reporter, that's a confirmation that the reporter's doing something right.
I just think it's the media has to do some self-examination, because I just think they're too interested in being advocates rather than reporting the news, and that's the biggest change I've seen in the last several decades.
I understand your point, but do you think by calling it the Gulf of America or by not calling it the Gulf of America, they're being activists?
No, I just I don't know who gets the call. That's a good question. I don't know who gets to name the ocean when there's more than one country. I don't think that's a big deal. That's why, you know, it's too heavy-handed to say, okay, you won't call the Gulf of America, so you can't be in the room.
You know,
I think the media, I mean, they are, I've seen it time and time again, they're slanted stories because they think they're doing justice by advocating for a position. And I always felt, I'm going to give you the truth and I'm going to give you some context. You decide. I'm not that smart. And I was, you know, I've been always center-right, conservative, but you couldn't tell from my reporting where I was. And I think that's the way everybody should be, shouldn't it?
Well, what is the situation when a politician, and just take it away from the current situation, tells a lie? Should you call it a lie? Should you call it out for its falsehoods? Should you just say, so-and-so said this, the sky was green today, the county executive said, but in fact, at noon, most people thought it was blue. I mean, you know.
Well, you know, but saying it's a lie is not the role of the press. The press is to present the evidence and say, this is what he said, and this is the evidence. But when you say you're lying.
Well, when the Washington Post did those truth, you know, fact-checking on the
The Pinocchio alerts.
Yeah, the Pinocchio alerts. Was that?
Well, you know, from their viewpoint, in the Washington Post, you know, that's a leftist organization. So
you know what? The truth is not a subjective thing. The truth is, a fact is a fact.
Who decides what the truth is? It's really about, once you take a side, and both sides do it. I mean, the media is.
I agree.
People watch what they want to hear. Conservatives watch Fox News because they tell them what they want to hear. Liberals watch MSNBC because they tell them what they want to hear. And you know what? There's enough of an audience to make money on cable at nighttime. And, you know, this is long before when I grew up, we had three TV stations and then the public station, and that was it. But I think people think, well, I got to get back at them, and just keep your cool, stay in the facts, and let people decide for themselves. I just feel there's this sense that the Trump voters are treated as if they're idiots, and they don't think about things that they should. And it's, you know, everybody's got a right to their votes, and we're a split country. It's been that way for a long time now, and I don't see any change coming.
Let's go to this letter from William. I was on Air France, an Air France, take two. I was on an Air France flight 2 weeks ago. On their in-flight app that lets you see the plane's path, the body of water south of Texas was still labeled Gulf of Mexico. Maybe Trump should ban Air France. Then I think obviously you're going to see a lot of atlases and books and globes that have been printed and published long, long ago that will have that for the foreseeable future. It's not the Gulf of Mexico, says Lisa. It's an inflated disguise to keep out real, true news. It's also a travesty. That is from Lisa. Okay, let's go to Seanan. S-E-A-N-A-N. How would you pronounce that? S-E-A-N-A-N. Seanan? Seanan?
Some could be totally different sometimes.
I want to go full Irish and call it Seanan, but I don't know. I don't know. Anyway, my apologies. We'll get it right. Let me know. An executive order is not solving a problem. It is simply kicking the can. It is term-limited. Bipartisan congressional lawmaking is to resolve the issue with immigration, and border control is solving the problem. All right. Thank you very much for that. Then we go to Bruce. To the extent that the Trump administration has
solve the border crisis. They have done it through repeated blatant violations of the U.S. Constitution and repeated attacks on the fundamental values of which this country was founded. Applauding the Trump administration's policies on immigration is spitting on the U.S. Constitution. Yes, we have an issue with immigration, but we should not solve these issues by destroying our country. We also go to Chuck. Having worked at a university, I know firsthand the value of creative thinking, whether technical or social. Some examples: universities developed the pacemaker, ultrasound, Coumadin, Gatorade, among other things. The importance of those may vary to you, but that's okay.
Relative
they
importance.
Gave us Gatorade.
I fear the bullying by this administration is negatively impacting the flow of results that benefit folks not only in the U.S., but the world. In other words, where will our future Gatorades come from? Let's see. Then we go to, one moment, please. We have about 3 minutes left, and I just want to get to a few more letters before we call it a morning. Trump and Stephen Miller are using the presidency to get their revenge on a world that sees them as losers. Instead, they are displaying to the whole world just completely that they are losers. But who won what? It's not okay. That is a letter that we read. Here we go to Brendan. I know everyone is frightened of this guy. Let's stop all this absurdity. He's finally become a dictator. Do not bend on his illegal words and deeds. We have got to stop this. And that is from Brandon. Rachel, reporting that something is a lie is not a viewpoint. The press needs to be responsible and report the truth, and journalists should not just parrot what the dear leader says. The journalists become propagandists when they just repeat. Otherwise, all news becomes those disgusting cabinet meetings.
Right. We talk about that on the Media Project quite a bit, the fact that if you just report what they say, you're basically a stenographer. Why, you know, AI is going to be able to replace you very easily.
But I think, Judy, it's giving, here's what he said, here's the facts from a legitimate organization. Well, you let the people judge this, if this study or organization, because I used to teach my students, there is no such thing as an independent study. Somebody's got to be financing it, and they have an interest in it. So it's really, the conclusion should be drawn by the public, and not by the journalist. I think that's crossing a line that's been a negative development in the history of journalism.
But if the journalist is the one who has done the study and has been able to, for want of a better word, prove that something is indeed a lie or is accurate or is not accurate, what's wrong with that?
Because the conclusion should be drawn by the viewer.
Well, so the journalist cites a Johns Hopkins study or a Pew Family Trust study that contradicts the assertion, and this is common all the time. That's perfectly legitimate. That's common. But if you do news analysis, where you pull together many different sources and you state something as a fact, because it's coming from many, many reputable sources, and then you use it to contradict an assertion made by a politician, that's the way journalism is. It's the conclusion of, you know, of everybody else, you know, essentially, with credibility says this, and the so-and-so says this.
Well, credibility is in the eye of the beholder. It's up to the journalist, the viewer, to determine who is credible and who is not.
We're out of time. I apologize. Okay. But my thanks to Mark and to Mike.
Good to be with you all.
Judy, wonderful. Thank you very much. We'll be back right after this.